Savitri, Book 1, The Book of Beginnings. Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. This is the first part at the beginning of the canto. It's pages 46 through 50. In 1947, in one of his letters on Savitri, Sri Aurobindo wrote that the three cantos about King Aswapati and his yoga at the end of Book 1, which are Cantos 3, 4, and 5, are about a part of his spiritual development which had two movements. The first movement was a psycho-spiritual transformation. The second movement will be in Canto 5. Sri Aurobindo says that it's a greater spiritual transformation with an ascent to a supreme power. And both of these are his own individual self-development and fulfillment. Later on, in Book 2 and in Book 3, his inner work will expand, first to represent all of mankind, when he goes through all the planes and parts of the being to find the Divine Mother, and finally, when he finds her, to include all of humanity. So now we're starting Canto 4, which is in between the two movements. Sri Aurobindo writes in a letter on Savitri in 1947 that in the second of these three cantos, there is a pause between the two yogic movements of Aswapati's own development, and there is a description of the secret knowledge to which he is led, the results of which are described in Canto 5. But there's no description of the yoga itself or of the steps by which this knowledge came. This letter could lead a person to think that the secret knowledge, which Sri Aurobindo writes about so beautifully, is not his own realization or experiences. But in a letter of May 4th of 1947, he writes, quote, "What I am trying to do everywhere in the poem is to express exactly something seen, something felt, or experienced." Then he goes on to say, "When the expression has been found, I have to judge, not by the intellect or by any set poetical rule, but by an intuitive feeling, whether it is the entirely right expression, and if it's not, I have to change and go on changing until I've received the absolutely right inspiration and the right transcription of it, and must never be satisfied with any à peu près, which is French and means partially done or imperfectly done, or any imperfect transcription, even if that makes good poetry of one kind or another." As so often in Savitri, when he speaks of man, Sri Aurobindo refers to the action of our psychic being without specifically naming it. But you can recognize it in the many ways that he talks about it through Savitri. At the end of this part of the canto, we have one of his very clear descriptions of our state, which certainly doesn't sound very enlightened. But it's our state when we are trying to search for something spiritual. Or maybe not our state, but the state of mankind trying to search for something spiritual. These first 4.5 pages of Canto 4 are the secret knowledge about what man can become, what he is becoming all the time, even if he doesn't know it, how it can happen, and also about the spiritual things behind our earthly covering. We know that he says that these are his own experiences and realizations. Richard from the archives has been able to find something in the record of yoga that is clearly an experience that Sri Aurobindo had. This time, we have different short diary notations on the same subject. They cover a span of time from February 7th, 1913 to May 20th, 1915. And they show Sri Aurobindo's noting of his own progress in certain particular areas. Some of them sound pretty complex and wordy, but that's because we've had to put the English in place of Sri Aurobindo's Sanskrit. He used one or two Sanskrit words that often take one or two sentences or even more to express in English. So, because I'm substituting Sri Aurobindo's definitions, which have been gathered from other parts of his writing, so that we only have Sri Aurobindo's definitions of these Sanskrit words, some of it seems not quite to fit, or it may come across a bit awkwardly. But we can still understand, and what we can really understand is how conscious he was. I mean, he really was totally aware of everything that was happening to him in such a high way and on such a high level. These also give us some really wonderful definitions of service to the divine as he was experiencing it, and obviously as it is experienceable by others. So here's the three lines in Savitri. A greater personality sometimes possesses us, which yet we know is ours, or we adore the master of our souls. On February 7th, 1913, Sri Aurobindo wrote, "The personality of the master is now occupying the life, in place of the active creator of the cosmos, whose being assumes by conscious will all kinds of properties, habits of cosmic character, and power of dynamic self-consciousness, all shaping the stuff of conscious being. It is no longer the Supreme Lord, the All-Ruler, or the Divine only, but the Supreme Being revealing himself as the God in man, who is also the Lord in the universe. At present, however, it is only in the personal relations with the master of the yoga that the substitution has been established." Almost a year later, on December 26, 1913, he writes, "The personality of the Supreme Lord and his relation with the individual soul are becoming more and more determined and frequent in action. Today, there was a descent into the vessel containing mind, life, and body of the Supreme Lord as the patient intellectual seeker and patient and laborious contriver who, step by step, occupies knowledge and action, and also is the boy with the aspect of strength and grandeur and rushing impetuosity and overbearing courage, enjoying the world game, powerful in temperament, and using life and action as a boy's game. The seat in the being of all this occupation is not, as before, the mind and intellect, but the intuitional mind and the temperament." On June 19, 1914, Sri Aurobindo wrote that he received a communication from automatic writing, something he called script and something which he received continually at this time. This was a group of different communications about things that were going on in him and moving towards fulfillment. Along with other different things, there are three that are in the numbered list of things. They are affirmations of what will take place in him. And these relate to our lines in Savitri. This is what he wrote. Quote, "The three other affirmations. Number 5, the personality of the All-Ruler, known as Krishna, the universal deity and supreme being, to be present in the consciousness, governing all the activities. 6, service to and surrender and submission to that which is beyond us, enabling the full and free working of the power of sweetness and ecstatic love that brings the highest sweetness and intimate control of the divine personality to be the personal relation of the individual soul with Krishna. This is the kind where the service and surrender is unable to disobey, but is worked mechanically through an intermediate impulsion of the active force of active nature, with the most intense consciousness of passive relation with the divine being. This is in the sense of being a living instrument in his hands, in the whole system. And the third one, number 7. Acceptance of all enjoyment as a slave and instrument of the lover to be the principle of the sweetness and ecstatic love that brings this intimate control of the divine personality to be the relation of the individual soul with Krishna, the universal deity and supreme being. So these are affirmations about something that's going to happen. And this was on the 10th of June of 1914. He's clearly been aware of this all along, because about 1 year later, on May 20th, 1915, he wrote about the progress he had made in realizing these three affirmations. He wrote that the accomplishments had taken a new turn and they could now be stated. And he gives them exactly the same numbering that he had given a year before. Number 5. The personality of Krishna is present in the consciousness, governing all the activities. But sometimes there comes the veil of the active force of nature. Number 6. The service of God in the world, of which the controlling power is the divinity within us, in the relation of ecstatic love and surrender to the divine, that brings the highest sweetness and intimate control of the divine personality. This is the state where this is the personal relationship of the individual soul with Krishna, when the service and surrender is unable to disobey, but is still worked mechanically through an intermediate impulsion of the active force of nature, with the most intense consciousness of passive relation with the divine being. All this, in the sense of being a living instrument in his hands, in the whole system. And all this is confirmed entirely, but not yet in full intensity. And number 7. Acceptance of the enjoyment as a slave and instrument of the lover, only now and finally accomplished. Intensity has yet to be given. So we start the secret knowledge, Canto 4. On a height he stood that looked towards greater heights. Our early approaches to the infinite, our sunrise splendors on a marvelous verge, while lingers yet unseen the glorious sun. What now we see is a shadow of what must come. The earth's uplook to a remote unknown is a preface only of the epic climb of human soul from its flat earthly state to the discovery of a greater self and the far gleam of an eternal light. This world is a beginning and a base where life and mind erect their structured dreams. An unborn power must build reality. A death-bound littleness is not all we are. Immortal, our forgotten vastnesses await discovery in our summit selves. Unmeasured breadths and depths of being are ours. Akin to the ineffable secrecy, mystic, eternal, in unrealized time, neighbors of heaven are nature's altitudes. To these high-peaked dominions, sealed to our search, too far from surface nature's postal routes, too lofty for our mortal lives to breathe, deep in us, a forgotten kinship points. And a faint voice of ecstasy and prayer calls to those lucent lost immensities. Even when we fail to look into our souls, or lie embedded in earthly consciousness, still have we parts that grow towards the light. Yet are there luminous tracts, and heaven serene, and Eldorados of splendor and ecstasy, and temples to the Godhead none can see. A shapeless memory lingers in us still, and sometimes, when our sight is turned within, Earth's ignorant veil is lifted from our eyes. There is a short, miraculous escape. This narrow fringe of clamped experience we leave behind, meted to us as life, our little walks, our insufficient reach. Our souls can visit, in great lonely hours, still regions of imperishable light, all-seeing eagle peaks of silent power and moon-flame oceans of swift, fathomless bliss and calm immensities of spirit space. In the unfolding process of the self, sometimes the inexpressible mystery elects a human vessel of descent. A breath comes down from a supernal air. A presence is born. A guiding light awakes. A stillness falls upon the instruments. Fixed, motionless, like a marble monument, stone calm, the body is a pedestal supporting a figure of eternal peace. Or a revealing force sweeps blazing in. Out of some vast superior continent, knowledge breaks through, trailing its radiant seas, and nature trembles with the power, the flame. A greater personality sometimes possesses us, which yet we know is ours, or we adore the master of our souls. Then the small bodily ego thins and falls, no more insisting on its separate self. Losing the punctilio of its separate birth, it leaves us one with nature and with God. In moments when the inner lamps are lit and life's cherished guests are left outside, our spirit sits alone and speaks to its gulfs. A wider consciousness opens then its doors, invading from spiritual silences. A ray of the timeless glory stoops a while to commune with our seized illumined clay and leaves its huge white stamp upon our lives. In the oblivious field of mortal mind, revealed to the closed prophet eyes of trance, or in some deep internal solitude, witnessed by a strange immaterial sense, the signals of eternity appear. The truth mind could not know unveils its face. We hear what mortal ears have never heard. We feel what earthly sense has never felt. We love what common hearts repel and dread. Our minds hush to a bright omniscient. A voice calls from the chambers of the soul. We meet the ecstasy of the Godhead's touch and golden privacies of immortal fire. These signs are native to a larger self that lives within us, by ourselves unseen. Only sometimes a holier influence comes. A tide of mightier surgings bears our lives, and a diviner presence moves the soul. or through the earthly coverings, something breaks. A grace and beauty of spiritual light, the murmuring tongue of a celestial fire. Ourself and a high stranger whom we feel. It is, and acts unseen, as if it were not. It follows the line of semi-paternal birth, yet seems to perish with its mortal frame. Assured of the apocalypse to be, it reckons not the moments and the hours. Great, patient, calm, it sees the centuries pass, awaiting the slow miracle of our change in the sure, deliberate process of world force and the long march of all revealing time. It is the origin and the master clue. A silence overhead, an inner voice, a living image seated in the heart, an unwalled wisdom and a fathomless point. The truth of all these cryptic shows in space, the real towards which our strivings move, the secret grandiose meaning of our lives. A treasure of honey in the combs of God, a splendor burning in a tenebrous cloak. It is our glory of the flame of God, our golden fountain of the world's delight. An immortality cowled in the shape of death, the shape of our unborn divinity. It guards for us our fate in depths within, where sleeps the eternal seed of transient things. Always we bear in us a magic key concealed in life's hermetic envelope. A burning witness in the sanctuary regards through time and the blind walls of form. A timeless light is in his hidden eyes. He sees the secret things no words can speak, and knows the goal of the unconscious world and the heart of the mystery of the journeying years. But all is screened, subliminal, mystical. It needs the intuitive heart, the inward turn. It needs the power of a spiritual gaze. Else, to our waking mind's small moment look, a goalless voyage seems our dubious course, some chance has settled, or hazarded some will, or a necessity, without aim or cause, unwillingly compelled to emerge and be. In this dense field, where nothing is plain or sure, our very being seems to us questionable. Our life, a vague experiment. The soul, a flickering light in a strange, ignorant world. The earth, a brute mechanic accident, a net of death, in which by chance we live. All we have learned appears a doubtful guess. The achievement done, a passage or a phase whose farther end is hidden from our sight. A chance happening or a fortuitous fate. Out of the unknown, we move to the unknown. Ever surround our brief existence here, gray shadows of unanswered questionings, the dark inconscience, signless mysteries stand up unsolved behind fate's starting line. An aspiration in the night's profound, seed of a perishing body and half-lit mind, uplifts its lonely tongue of conscious fire towards an undying light forever lost. Only it hears, sole echo of its call, the dim reply in man's unknowing heart, and meets, not understanding why it came, or for what reason is the suffering here, God's sanction to the paradox of life, and the riddle of the immortal's birth in time.